and welcome back to this episode of the Rugby Paper Podcast. Plenty on the menu today, and joining us as we discuss the Champions Cup semi-finals, Antoine Dupont, Sevens and the Olympics, is USA Sevens head coach Mike Friday. Welcome back to the Rugby Paper Podcast. Champions Cup semis done and dusted, and for once our predictions were actually spot on. I mean, there are only two of them, but we were right, so we'll give ourselves a little pat on the back because we don't get many. Queens and Northampton were both left with first half deficits, and both looked like at one point that they could overturn them, but came short of doing so. We'll have a look at those games. We've also got our first ever special guest from the world of sevens. USA head coach Mike Friday joins us, so we'll turn our attention towards Sevens League finale, or Sevens season finale, sorry, in Madrid, and then, of course, the Olympics. For now, though, it's just myself and the columnist. We've got about 20, 25 minutes to get into it. Chewy, you weren't with us last week. Welcome back.
That's why your predictions were successful.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Why? Mm. Did you see two England wins coming?
Whoever lost, I thought would win.
Funny, that's always the case with you.
I'm nothing if not consistent.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, I'll reinitiate you with a Leinster question, because every time you speak about Leinster, the comment section gets aggy. It was a bit of a tale of two halves, wasn't it? And I guess Northampton are ruining the fact they didn't show up in the first.
Well, they were all over the place, Northampton, weren't they? I don't know whether that was the Croke Park effect. I remember England going to Croke Park when Brian Ashton was coach and not seeming to be completely in tune with the surrounding atmosphere. They were absolutely marmalised that day. I thought Northampton were really disappointed in that first half. I don't think they cut their suit really to suit their cloth. I thought they were over ambitious, and I don't think that was arrogance. I think that was a sign of nerves. When you're playing against a side of that quality, and yes, I do think Leinster have the most enormous advantages over and above pretty much any other side in the British Islands, if we can still call it that. But they are a heck of a side, come what may. And to try and take some of the liberties that Northampton did in the first quarter of an hour or so, I thought was naive at best. And I thought Finn Smith was a principal architect of that misfortune. However, I think he played extremely well in the second half. And I admired the way they stuck at it. I mean, they're clearly very, very together as a unit. But crikey, they were pretty poor in that first half hour or so.
I think they were between a rock and a hard place. We were talking last week. They needed to get off to a start. Now, obviously, every team needs to get off to a start. But Leinster hadn't played for 3 weeks, or that group hadn't played for 3 weeks. So there was the logic was there. Get out the blocks. But they were so anxious. And then, as you say, the Croke Park effect was that they actually managed nothing for 39 minutes.
Somebody said on the TV, Bren, that James Lowe had played one URC game all season.
Yeah, this is why people get aggy with Leinster. They're an entirely different setup to the rest. They're not even a club, as far as I'm concerned. They're a national franchise. They're an entirely different setup to the rest of European rugby. But they're a very fine team. Having said that, I thought Saints were outstanding in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
To produce that after successive weekends of pretty torrid premiership games, certainly, adrenaline-fueled premiership games, which would leave you tired, was absolutely outstanding. And yes, yet again, they didn't get any favours from the ref. For Saints, 90 seconds out, 30 yards out under the post, to get blown for diving into a ruck. Well, yes, I think strictly speaking they did, but you'd have to penalise Leinster 20 times a match for the same offence.
They
spend their entire match on four paws or flopped on the ruck.
Oh,
get away with it.
Rucks when Leinster are playing are like no man's land. There's bodies all over the place.
But they don't get reffed.
Unbelievable.
Saints get reffed then, but is that bizarre?
It is.
Yeah, but they're
extraordinary.
all
And
good.
I would also say hang on, Nick, just one sec. I was really impressed with Sam Bestu, who I think is a very impressive figure anyway, and has clearly got a heck of a future in coaching, if the right people look at him and make decisions on his behalf. But he said, "We'll sort this." When during the commentary, when they went to him, and Northampton were taking a right battering at that
Yeah,
point,
he was calm and cool,
he
wasn't he?
said, "We'll sort it." And I thought, even you, Sam, who's one of the more grounded coaches, I think, and he's not prone to exaggeration. I thought, you're talking out of your rear end here. You're not going to sort this side of Christmas. However, he was absolutely right. They did work out a way to ask Leinster a load of questions that Leinster didn't really enjoy answering very much, and that's to the coach's credit and also the players.
Yeah. Well, I thought that we had two English sides, two Premiership sides that came up against obviously very, very strong opposition and the weaknesses of the Premiership on the negative side. On the plus side, I thought that they both hung in there incredibly well and both played at times very, very well indeed. But the weakness of the Premiership, if you can call it a weakness, is that they're the game, certainly at the top end and really all the way through, has been about unbridled attack. And some teams defend very well. I wouldn't put Toulouse in the same bracket as Leinster in that respect, but Leinster have a pretty, a pretty shut tight defence. And they had a plan for Northampton, and Northampton didn't see their plan coming. And that was that they blitzed in the middle, just one guy blitzing. They wheeled the scrum, sometimes illegally, I would have said, but they got away with it. And Northampton didn't look at the blind side option at all. Playing by rote, trying to get the ball down along the line, and their line was under severe pressure. Their attacking line was under severe pressure. Their line out was also under severe pressure. Again, a Premiership weakness. Too many sides do not compete at the line out. Leinster competed at the line out very effectively. And I think that those two things, the wave them through Premiership cost both sides. They were both caught out defensively. I thought for Northampton, I mean, how they replaced Courtney Laws, I don't know. But I thought that he was absolutely remarkable again. And Augustus played the best game I think I've
Didn't he
seen.
what? Didn't he just?
Yes, he did.
Those two pulled them back almost into the game. I thought Finn Smith did look caught in the headlights in the first half, and he did sort it out in the second and showed, as they all do, showed real grit. But the Premiership has to look at itself. This is a game which is about a balance between attack and defence. At the moment, it's slewed in the Premiership too far towards an attacking game in which, when they get to play at a level that's pretty well getting on for international level, which is where you're at in European semi-finals, you've got to have a bit more defensively than both of them had. Right, and that is even allowing for Laws's bloody extraordinary feats.
Just on the subject of Laws, I think I'm right in saying when we picked our British and Irish lines 15, he wasn't actually a name that was mentioned in the discussion. I think he absolutely should have been. What do you guys make of that? Have there been situations? I suppose there have been situations in the past, 2013 being one of them, the last time we were in Australia, where people retired from international rugby have been on tour. So does he come on the plane? I mean, the way he's playing, you can't argue against it.
Yeah, I can't remember how we covered that. Did we not mention him? Was that something along the lines of we assume he's not available or whatever? But yeah, in 2 years' time, why not? I mean, if he's playing like that, you cannot not pick him.
But he's going to be playing in Provence, isn't he? So that's going to be a difficult one, really.
It'd almost be as well rested as James Lowe then.
Actually, no, they'll work him. Actually, they'll work
Well,
him.
there you go.
Yeah.
I have to say on him, I spent years of it wasn't that I wasn't his biggest fan. He obviously had terrific attributes right from the start. I mean, but he seemed to me to be in a bit of a one-trick pony kind of place for some years at the start. And fair enough, it was a good trick. No one likes being tackled the way Courtney Laws tackles you. It was a hell of a trick. And he's athletically and physically in all senses, you know, he is the epitome of the modern day top end pro back rower, back five player. But the knowledge he's put onto his game in recent years, I mean, it's not so much an Indian summer. It's just watching a player grow and grow and grow until he's almost a sort of master of he's a master of his art at the moment. And that's fantastic. And yes, I mean, it might come that kind of accolade might come late in his career, but it's just a sign that, you know, the more you play, the more you understand, the better you are.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the England back row is one of the units that isn't exactly short of names, but even before his international retirement, we can't remember the last time he had a bad game for England.
No, I mean, the last time England were in Australia, he again virtually pulled them through to win that series, you know, by himself, certainly in the final test. You know, he was phenomenal. And yeah, I mean, he is a great rugby player, I
I mean,
would say.
it was Finn Smith said afterwards he'd put him potentially second to Dupont as the best player in the world, which maybe is a slight stretch, but he's, you know, he's in the discussion this year, certainly.
I mean, just to endorse what Chris was saying, I initially didn't like it when he switched from second row to number six. I didn't think he had the skills, but proved me incredibly wrong. You know, he's learned the skills. He on the ground, he's now fantastic. You know, scrabbling around on the ground, he never used to do that. His handling has improved. His tight work has improved, and he's always been the big hit merchant, the line out man, great athlete across the park. I mean, you know, he has got it all. Yeah, I think he warrants discussion as one of the world's best players below Dupont.
And the game's moved in his direction, isn't it?
Yeah,
So, I mean,
there's that.
the way back rows play, because they're all multitasking now.
Yeah.
So you don't have that real position-specific separation that you used to have in the classical back rows of the fetcher and the carrier and the football net and all that kind of thing. Everyone does a bit of everything now, or everyone does a lot of everything, extraordinarily, and it suits him because the strengths that he had at the start of his career are not redundant because he moved back from second row to six. He just needs to put other things on his game, which he has.
You can't tackle like that unless you've got great timing. He's got great timing, but the other thing that he is a phenomenal athlete. You know, you remember that cover tackle that he, or more than a cover tackle that he made against Tonga when he captained them in the autumn a couple of years ago, where he covered pretty well the length of the pitch to cut down Talusevianu, who's no slouch.
No.
So,
It's where you hope someone like Cunningham South will get to, isn't
yeah, and that's quite possible too, I think, you
it?
know, judging by what we saw against Toulouse. But you know, great salute to Courtney Laws. You know, I mean, I think for him to be, you know, producing the level of performance that he is at the moment is real testimony to the man. You
Well,
know.
put it this way, I don't know if you've done it yet, but we've recently had to vote for the Pat Marshall Award Player of the Year. And there was a worthy shortlist of about seven or eight, and it took me a nanosecond or less to vote for Courtney Laws. I mean, he's just been the man.
You and me both.
Guys, keep your votes to yourselves.
Yeah, it's a secret
So,
ballot. It's a
have I
secret
broken some
ballot.
election rule now or something?
No.
I've done a Laura Koonsberg.
Chewy voted for Manu Tuilagi, but he's just not going to tell us.
Well, I voted for him every year since he last played well.
Well, in your eyes, that's probably a lot of years, isn't it? Let's talk about Toulouse a little bit. We could talk about Dupont, but I think we'll probably save that for when Mike Friday joins us for obvious reasons. I'd love to find out what the sort of reaction in the Sevens world has been to having the Dupont factor migrate over there. But his partnership with Untermac is now looking like it's, well, it wasn't really gone for very long as soon as Untermack was back, but it's looking like it's clicking. So yeah, how great is it to see Untermack back, and he's now looking like he's somewhere near the peak of his powers?
He's got a point of difference, Untermack, hasn't he? I don't think there's another 10 in the world who plays quite like him. He is he's a master, if you can be, of the indefinables of the game. I mean, he's unpredictable. I think he sees things that other people don't, and that allows him to do things that other people wouldn't really think of doing until it's too late to do them, by which time he's already done them. There's a cracking sentence for you.
I would ask you to repeat that, Chris.
Hyperbole and impenetrable. what I notice about him is he's a fantastic passer of the ball.
Yeah,
you know, and he's a little bit like, you know, he always seems to be in balance. He always seems to, you know, he's a little bit. I was looking at the old Lions coverage of Barry John. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that he's Barry John, but he's got great, great balance and great distribution, and those, and he's very quick too, I think.
So, in another age, Nick, he'd have been the French 12, wouldn't he? He'd have been the French inside centre.
Yeah.
You know, they used to have their kicking 10s. All the governance is done by 9, a kicking 10, and then you had the Didier Cordonniers, people like that, at 12, who were not the biggest, but their passing
skills
were just wondrous.
Talking of which, Chris, I think France have seen their next 12, and it's Paul Costa, the young blonde lad, who was star man this time last year for the under-20s. And he's been bloody good for about 2 months now in that Toulouse side. He's really coming on. Yeah. So I can see him going straight through starting place for France next season. Hell of a player.
I think that French side who won the under-20s, I don't know, when he was in it, so what was that, a couple of years ago, when they had Jeannot. I know he had his issues playing for Clermont a little bit, but he's a kid. I mean, if ever anyone was a mini Dupont, it's him. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be that good, but he's a heck of a player. That was a really strong French under 20 side, and Costa was a big, not just because of his hair, which is really annoying actually, because he's too good looking for words, but he's a clever player, a really good player.
And he's a tough boy as well. I mean, he's got the works. He's
well, you have to be with that hair.
Well, you'd have to, in fairness. Rougerie survived though with good hair.
Who was it who caught up with him and rearranged his windpipe? Was that Phil Greening?
That was Cockerell, Cockers.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I mean, we've had the Jalibert Untermack debate on this podcast a couple of times, and I think Untermack offers a couple of things that Jalibert doesn't. And there have been times on this podcast where a few people have sung the Jalibert praises, and I can see where they're coming from. But Untermack, one, is defence, and he handled Andre Esterhazy was running down his channel pretty regularly on Saturday, and he handled that pretty well. But also, I think, and Chewy, I'll reintroduce you here again, but when Toulouse or France are under the cosh, and they were a lot in the Six Nations, and Jalibert seemed unable to not only, well, one, come up with the answers, but two, just weather the storm generally. I think Untermack did that in that second half on Sunday, it was, and obviously saw Toulouse through.
I thought pre-World Cup, when Untermack was out and Jalibert was obviously going to be their first choice 10, the way Jalibert was playing at that point, I think I may have even said on this podcast that it's possible that he'll make Untermack irrelevant or make his absence irrelevant.
Yeah.
Along with most of the things I say on this podcast, that turned out not to be true.
With that being said, Jalibert did have a very good...
He had a good World Cup.
Yeah, he did. But I think the French side, as I would love to see them play, there's more chance of them really hitting the heights that they're capable of with Untermack at 10. Because he's just unusual.
Interesting.
And if he's unusual for everyone who's sitting there watching, he might be unusual. He might be slightly difficult to analyse. And if you're difficult to analyse, then crikey, you've got a few feathers in your cap there.
And like Jalibert, he has his, you know, he's not always on.
No, he has his funny moments, doesn't he?
Yeah. And so it's I would say that your idea of a 10-12 partnership of Jalibert and Ntamack might be quite an interesting one.
I didn't quite suggest that. I'd sooner watch Ntamack played than Les Gaboura.
I mean, Ntamack started his France career at 12. I know Jalibert wasn't 10. I think it was probably Camille Lopez, but they have run Jalibert and Ntamack together.
And it didn't work very well.
No. Maybe we just, I mean, Ntamack's got great hair as well. Maybe the French should just pick their back line according to who has the best lids.
Well, now you're just stereotyping French rugby.
I'm just naming two people.
I mean, you'll be banging on about Jean-Pierre Reeve next.
I don't think he's still... Well, actually,
he was only ever picked because he was blonde.
I don't think he's still blonde, though. Guys, we've got Mike Friday probably joining us in a couple of minutes. Let's sort of funnel in Dupont very briefly, just because, and we'll look ahead to the final properly in the week leading up to it. But in Jameson Gibson-Park and Antoine Dupont, you've probably got about as box office a head-to-head as you could wish to see, because they're probably, I know we mentioned Courtney Laws, but they're probably the two best players in the world.
Well, that's true. What I do think is, just one step aside from that, I think the key player, the way he's playing at the moment, one of the key players in that final will be this bloke, Kroos, who had a hell of a game in the back row for Toulouse at the weekend. I mean, there are things he doesn't do, but the things he does do, Christ, he is some act at the moment. I mean, he's really destructive, and he's the kind of bloke who could get stuck in the Leinster at the tackle area big time and make their life really, really uncomfortable. So
yeah, Jack Willis too.
He played very well at the weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, that didn't answer my question in the slightest.
No.
But thanks.
But Jameson Gibson-Park, all right. Well, okay, in deference to you, because you run this thing, Ollie, Jameson Gibson-Park is obviously box office just as Dupont is. But if Francois Kroos does what he did to Leinster, what he did to Harlequins, Jameson Gibson-Park, your mate, will not have a particularly comfortable ride.
Mm.
Who's more important to their side out of Gibson-Park to Leinster and Dupont to Toulouse? If one of them gets rattled, how likely is that to sort of, well, hamper their team's chances?
Well, I don't think Dupont will get rattled. I've never seen him get rattled. I don't think that'll happen. I can't remember Gibson-Park getting rattled particularly, but he does operate behind this dominant Ireland Leinster pack 90% of the time. And we haven't really seen him under that much pressure, have we? Is he the same player when it's really tough, when he's on the back foot, when you've got Jack Willis and Cross all over him at the breakdown trying to get at him? Well, that's going to be an important moment, I think. But at the moment, I can't really remember him having a bad game either.
I mean, just a slight tangent, but one of the things that concerns me about Quins is, what do they do when Esterhazen and Herbst have gone? I think Herbst's been huge for them.
Hasn't he, yeah.
As the tractor lock over the course of the season. And I just sort of think that the hole that's going to be left there is huge. And
they'll go and get Charlie Matthews back, like for like.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got plenty of backs, haven't they? But they haven't got an Esterhazen, have they? They've got some good young... Well, would Northmore go to that role? He's a big lump and a good player.
He's not Andre Esterhazen. I don't know.
You're not going to find another Andre Esterhazen. There'll be about three of him in the world, and they're all in South Africa at the moment.
Do you reckon Quinn's wiring up Geordie Barrett and Leinster got there first? Geordie Barrett would have been great to see.
Geordie Barrett would have fitted in perfectly there.
He's wildly overrated. Wildly overrated.
You'd pick Manu Tuilagi any day.
Oh, in my sleep. I mean, absolutely. I mean, Manu's range of skills compared to the one-trick pony Geordie Barrett are extraordinary.
Anyone who's not listened to the podcast before will actually you've pinned your opinions to the mast there, Chewy, as a Geordie Barrett hater, so well done. Well, let's get your... Mike Friday's doing his hair, so he tells me. Speaking of great haircuts, so we can set our expectations big for when he clocks in. But let's get... Let's get your predictions for the Champions Cup final then. Toulouse or Leinster?
If I fancy Toulouse, actually. I think they'll just have a bit too much. And I think Northampton have kind of signalled the way how to get at them. I think they've got quality across. I mean, hell of a match, but Toulouse for me by a score.
And Leinster are all going to have a collective nosebleed because they're leaving Dublin.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was interesting is that sort of, I think it ended up being almost a 3-week gap for some of their players.
Well, it was. They had two matches in South Africa over successive weekends, and it was a week off before that and a week off after that. I mean, so they were
3 weeks. And I reckon that in the second half, it caught up with them a bit. I think that they weren't, you know, I mean, I just think that they weren't match hardened in some ways. And it could catch up with them again, possibly. You know, I mean, it depends what sort of a run in they've got in the URC, but they might go to the other end where they end up being fatigued.
Do we know who's reffing it? That's not been announced yet, has it?
No, I don't think so.
Not my knowledge, no.
That will be interesting. I mean, the moment Leinster come into somebody who's going to take a dim view of what they do at the breakdown, that could have a massive effect. I would also say that the chances of Toulouse going into the final without Thomas Ramos, much as I think Kinghorn's a good player, I think in a final with his kicking...
Kinghorn also busted his nose on... He posted quite a great picture on his Instagram of his nose being at that angle. So I think that decision might be made for them. But, I mean, you're right. You've got to have Ramos at the start of a game like that. It's been weird that he hasn't started.
I mean, one of the areas where Leinster, people gloss over sometimes, you know, the line-out is such an important part of possession these days and the quality of line-out that you get. And it's interesting, you know, that if you looked at Northampton's line-out in the Premiership, it's one of the best line-outs that there is. The speed of ball that they get off the top from Laws and others is fantastic. Against Leinster, they didn't. Leinster put their big guys up and getting off the ground against them, and they messed up Northampton's lineup to a fair degree. I'm not sure about Toulouse's lineup. That lineout that could be an area where they're you're not going to get Miafu too high in the air.
you could try.
I mean, Flamand and Rumah are okay, but Miafu, who weighs more than the two of them combined, is a difficult man to lift, I would grant.
Yeah, and I think he's probably doing the lifting, to be honest. But anyway, you know, I just think that that's an area where Leinster could possibly get into Toulouse. And I think that the scrum, funnily enough, is an area where Toulouse could get into Leinster, because I don't think that Tag Furlong looked at his best. I think he got away with a lot, and the same with Porter.
Yeah.
Against the Northampton scrum that's been sound, but it isn't considered to be one of the really powerful packs.
You all laughed when I said Furlong was on the way down during our Lions discussion. You all said I didn't know what I was talking about, and I was talking out of my rear end.
None of us.
I remember it distinctly.
I'm not suggesting that it's terminal.
Chris, that's the voice in the back of your head anytime you express some sort of opinion.
Mike Friday will back me up on this because he's a scrum technician and he knows what he's talking about.
Your hair looks great, Mike.
Thank you. I was dying.
Nice hair, Mike. Not as nice as Paul Coste, but nice hair.
Yeah, we were just chatting about the France backline having the greatest haircuts in world rugby.
Yeah. lots of dodgy shaved sides of the heads and mullets.
Except the sainted DuPont. The only flaw I can see in this remarkable human being, he's got a little bit of a bald patch coming at the back there at the age of 28 or 27. That's the only thing I can find to say against him.
Well, your phenomenal stat that he's already played more minutes of rugby than Johnny Sexton did in his whole career. You cannot play that amount of rugby without ending up with a receding hairline. You can't do it.
No, that's a fair point.
How are you, Mike? Are you back? Not... Where are you?
I'm back in London. I got back on Monday, and then fly back on Sunday. So 4 days, kind of sweeping visit, check in with the boys, my boys, and then we're back at it, getting ready for just, well, I mean, I don't know whether we'll talk about it or not, how much, but getting ready for, as I would call it, roulette relegation. So, yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting time, but yeah, the boys need a couple of days off recover, so they have that, and then we're back at it on Monday.
Is that what? So between tournaments, obviously, it's usually about a month between seven tournaments, and
yeah,
with the odd consecutive weekend. What does day to day look like for you?
Well, day to day there.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a nightmare right now because of the tight turnarounds, right? Because they changed it from being 5 weeks to 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's made a significant difference, especially on these Asian leg travel distances, which are ridiculous. Well, they're ridiculously long anyway, right? 16-hour flights, anything between an 8 and a 10-hour time zone change. So the implications for doing that once are one thing, but then losing a week between tournaments of recovery has actually had quite an interesting effect on some of the number of injuries that we've had. Not us, but well, we've had a couple, but across the whole series on this particular leg. But we'll land it out Monday, so they'll be off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They'll be back in Friday for recovery and get the legs moving, open up the lungs, off for the weekend, and then we're back in earnest next Monday.
Yeah.
Where we'll have an intense week of prep. We then have a second week, which is more a travel week, so it won't necessarily be tapered, but it will be certainly front-ended. And then we will travel to Madrid, but we'll come in via London. So I was gonna take them straight to Madrid, right? But it's not Malaga, so the cuisine is not really to the American boys' kind of liking. So we're coming via London because that's what we would normally do for the London Sevens when that was on. Yeah. So we'll stay in Teddington and Twickenham at the Pope on the corner in Twickenham, which do a decent breakfast, which they love, and then we'll take them out on that kind of first day, first evening. They like a good curry, and then they'll have Sunday to themselves, and they'll all go off into London Borough Market, just exploring. They all enjoy that part of London, and then we'll fly out Monday to Madrid and get ready for the week, which accumulates in roulette on Friday, Saturday.
Mike, can you just explain to us and the listeners what's exactly at stake at Madrid this year round? What are the issues that are going to be decided on this final weekend?
Yeah, I mean, the whole series has been reformatted, and it's been an interesting adjustment, right? And the problem is, it's very easy for us all to chuck stones, right? Oh, this is wrong, that is wrong. But if we don't try these things, we don't know. But unfortunately, we probably paid the price, because the way it works is they took it down from 16 to 12 teams. Now, on the men's side, that's made it ridiculously competitive at the best of times. Now, from that, eight of the 12 go and compete for the World Series, let's just call it, right? Which is the one-off winner-takes-all championship in Madrid. The bottom four, so 33% of that league go into relegation group, which is actually where we've ended up off the back of what has been just a ridiculous season, where we've made 6 out of 7 of the quarterfinals. Only Ireland have made more. And yet, with the way that you can't play out for your placing games, we've always been lumbered in 7th and 8th because of the way that the formula works, which doesn't make sense, but it is what it is. And you don't know till you try it. So we just have to suck it up and swallow. So we're now going to Madrid in that bottom 8 tournament, which is the four that are in the relegation zone of the World Series, and then the best 4 from the challenger. Now, rather than that be a round robin, the best 4 stay up, they decided to make 2 pools of 4, but it's not a pool of the World Series and a pool of the Challenger Series. It's a mixed pools. You play each other to get your ranking within the pool, and then you play a one-off game with the corresponding player team in the other pool. So one will play 4 and 2 will play 3. So you could end up with four one-off games where everybody's cannibalising one another on the World Series, and the four Challenger Series could be playing against themselves as well. So it's a system that's a bit flawed, right? But they're trying to create winner-takes-all, last game of the day, every time, all the time, because that suits broadcasting. So there's a few things at play, right? And money's a big part of it. But we're in the wrong one. Let's just say that, and we've got to go hard on this relegation roulette, where we've got to basically try and finish top of our group, which we're more than capable of doing. And then hopefully that means we play seed four in the other group. And if that goes to form,
are you comfortable, Mike, that your explanation has just lasted longer than the game of sevens?
I mean, yeah, and that's the point, right? This is the point. So to Joe Soap and Joe Punt, they're like, oh my God, it's just not, it's just too complicated. And that was the feedback, like when this was all being put together. And like I said, it's very easy for us all to criticise. And right now I'm heavily criticising because of where we're at. But when you take a step back, it's like they've got to find a way to fully embrace and show the game of sevens. And it's a great game. It's fast moving and so forth. But the reality is, from a broadcast perspective, it's on for too long. So if you're in stadium experience, then actually great. And the days have made longer now because it's men and women, but it's not men and women in sessions so that you cater for every rugby fan. It's men, then women, then men, then women, then men, then women. That means it just caters for that rugby fan who enjoys all rugby. It doesn't cater for the rugby fan who just likes women's rugby or just likes men's rugby. And they're very different audiences, as we see. You know, you hear a very different type of crowd when you hear the Red Roses selling out 60,000 at Twickenham to when the men play. So we're not. I think we have got to get the balance right on how you package it up, and how you showcase it in stadium, and then how you can maximise it from a broadcast perspective. So there's lots of things going on, and that's before they actually, like you said, simplify the format. And it's too extreme at the moment. I mean, 33% of the teams being put at risk is ridiculous. I don't think there's a league in the world, yeah, in any sport where that happens.
It also sounds as if the format's too fragmented, Mike. You know, I mean, the idea that you've got to have a men's game followed by a women's game followed by a men's game, so on, that's nonsense. You lose the narrative of the competitiveness of a particular tournament. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be played on the same day in part or whatever else, but they need to be played in blocks so people can get an idea of who's who.
And if you're a spectator, you have to take two different sets of clothes, because if you were having a series at Twickenham, if you were watching the blokes, you'd have to wear your mustard-coloured corduroys, wouldn't you? but they really don't suit the women's game.
No, and this is the point. We're trying to, you know, we're driving equality and we're driving equal opportunity, and everyone understands that. It can still be packaged in a different way that appeals to the varying and the different spectator and bases that we have. And, you know, like, I would hazard a guess there's lots of mums and daughters that would like to do sessions of watching the women's game only. And the beauty of the World Series in the 70s is creating the outside of experiences as well, you know, the festival experience, whereby they can go out and they can do the food halls or the food markets. They can do, the boys can go off drinking, they like the men's, and there can be loads of things that cater for the children. I mean, that's what Dubai does really well, but it's again, it's a different environment and a different festival, because that's kind of rugby tournaments within the main rugby tournament, which is kind of the old traditional way. But they have captured and created the outdoor other experiences that will increase dwell time and, for all intents and purposes, bring more revenues onto the site. So I think we've kind of lost a little bit of focus of how to maximise potential revenue streams, together with also maximise the spectator base.
I was going to ask you that, Mike, just to broaden it out. In the Olympic age, if you like, do you think that Sevens has maximised itself? Do you think it's done a good enough job at putting itself in front of eyeballs as it might have done?
I think when you actually look at the Olympic experience, when you watch the eyeballs that watch the Olympics and the Olympic rugby and the feedback that gets, we're doing a fantastic job. Yeah. I think where we need to be better, and where I think there's real opportunity to commercialise and be a little bit more show busy and entertainment, is on the World Series. And I think we're not hitting that at the moment. You know, there's a horrible, ugly word that people need to embrace, which is the world of gaming or gambling, which in the world of sevens, which is the perfect vehicle and the perfect marketplace, you know, short games, anything can happen, volatile. It appeals to a set of eyeballs that may not have an interest in actually the history of the game, but it's certainly got a huge interest into the adrenaline piece and what that can bring for them. So I think there's some modernization that we could do and probably do kind of safely and in the right way that could innovate the game, which could reposition us from a commercial perspective, which would stop us necessarily being an expense for World Rugby and Unions to actually be coming into a revenue generating type of arena. So,
are you suggesting it should be called the Betfred Sevens?
Well, you call it what you like. I mean, I think I think in terms of that marketplace and that business, you know, it's huge. It's huge in American football. It's huge in basketball. You can still protect the integrity of the game, which is ultimately what World Rugby want to do, and we all agree with that. But you know, look at cricket. You know, the way that they frame and they've innovated to create the different formats. And I know we'll have the traditionalists that go, well, it's not proper cricket. Well, okay, it's great. We've still got 15s is ultimately in the rugby mature world is the kingpin. But these other forms, and sevens falls into that, are the sexy piece that will bring the new eyeballs and the new audiences, of which some will transfer across the 15s, and a huge just won't. And both is fine.
Is
the real problem, Mike, that they continue messing around with formats in sevens, so that the public doesn't really engage with it in the way in which it might, because it's too fragmented.
I think there's got to be. I think they've had a decent stab at trying to get continuity in the season. I just think they need to get the periods consistent, and we need to make a decision whether they're standalones or they're going to be back to backs. I think if we sort the format like you suggested, you know, you can't go man, woman, man, woman, men's, women. You create either different events or you create blocks or sessions, which works really well in the Olympics. Then I think you can embrace it in terms of where it sits in the global calendar. I think they'll never be perfect, as we know. And ultimately, I think that's probably one of its biggest advantages, because the rugby mature nations, it will sit in a different part of the pyramid to the emerging nations, where it will sit differently. And those nations like America and Canada that are very very Olympic focused. And that will give further exposure to many different players to probably excel. And our game is a late development sport as well, which we kind of do seem to forget sometimes, especially if you haven't made it at 18, 19 in the 15, where you're never making it. Well, then the way that we have our university system and how that could embrace and create rugby players and rugby stars of tomorrow is clear to see by all, because, you know, that's how Amor ultimately found his way into the world of professional rugby. So I think we get the season right, we set on what the number of tournaments are, and then the key bit, like the crucial bit, is how it's formatted in each individual tournament to maximise in-stadium experience as well as broadcasting and commercial opportunities. And I think the other piece, which is an interesting one again, which is a little bit controversial, but hey, that's me, is do we create private entities within unions to allow them to drive them in a commercial way? What I mean by that is, in the old days on the cycling, you had the Sky team, didn't you, that ultimately then fed the Team GB. Is like, do you create those within unions so that they can create their own kind of commercial business that sits attached to the NGB, which represents the country, but it again is not a burden of cost. It's a revenue generating part of their business, and that would sit quite nicely with how they've done that in cricket on the IPL side.
Well, that's the $64 million question, literally, isn't it? And the question is, and everyone looks at the IPL when we talk in these terms, because that is a wildly successful. I mean, you love it or hate it, it's a wildly successful commercial venture. But what IPL can do is attract the biggest names in the cricketing world. which Rugby Sevens, with can't. One notable exception, which we'll ask you about, and what you think Dupont means to Sevens in the long run. Can Sevens possibly fulfil itself commercially and in profile terms without not just one Dupont, but a bag of them from around the world?
Yeah, so I would probably say yes, because I think in the nicest possible way, I think we've become very insular to the when we're in our small parts of the world that 15s is the king, right? But ultimately, when you look at the geographies and the landmass of those countries, they're not that big a landmass in the context of the whole world, right? It's just the British Empire and France. So the long
we don't have an empire anymore, Mike. I don't exactly. know. I mean, we often have this discussion on the podcast. The last time I looked.
But anyway, you know what you know it. But, yeah, you know what I mean. But, and I think the reality is, it's like when you look at the stars that Fiji have created, you know, the traditionalists. But, you know, like this, like Perry Baker has become a huge star in his own right. But he's more renowned everywhere else around the world than America. But that's a different, that's a unique thing to our landscape. So I think we can create those stars, and they'll be different. They won't be as significant as Dupont, because he sits in that mature 15s world. But, you know, if Perry Baker landed in the islands of Fiji, it'd be interesting who'd get more attention, whether it be Dupont or Perry. So, and it's not to take away from those superstars, because they are the superstars that they are, like Dupont, and richly deserved to be that. But I think if we create, because I think if the World Supers don't get it right, I can see private investors going, you know what? Hong Kong stands alone, Dubai stands alone. We've got the fundamentals here. We just need, you know, we've got the new thing going on in India this summer. And then you can see Qatar, or you could see the Middle East getting involved. And you could see very quickly, you could create a 4 or 5 tournament series, which ends up being $1 million here, $1 million there. And then the reality is, rugby players will go, well, where do I get my biggest return? Which is what's happened in cricket, right? They go off for their 6 weeks in the Big Bash and they move on to somewhere else. So I do think there's an opportunity. I don't think it will ever, and nor should it, replace the world of 15s and what that means. But I do think it's a bigger world than what we think, in terms of those nations that can embrace the rugby game of sevens. And, you know, you look at on the men's side, you know, if USA can embrace it, then China are going to be looking over the fence for sure. And then the other big piece is India. Now, on the women's side, it will be easier because the athletic physiques are more aligned. So for those nations to embrace and compete on the Olympic stage, and if, you know, the populations they have, then it's huge on the women's side. So I think the opportunity is huge there. But even so, on the men's side, there is a big world out there that could be exploited using the game of sevens, which you wouldn't be able to do with the game of 15 because of the nuances of the front five.
You've got a good point there, Mike. I mean, I wrote for 20 years I wanted sevens in the Olympics, and I was a huge supporter of it. I have to say, I've been ever so slightly disappointed at its impact, and there are reasons. It got sidelined into a bit of a minor stadium in 2016 in Brazil, and it coincided with some big events. And then, of course, COVID, of all the sports that need a crowd, want a crowd, feed off a crowd, it's sevens. But that's slightly negative. But now you've got sevens in France, Olympics, 40,000. Where has it been held? Is it the stand?
It's
or is it
bad. It's
right, so 75,000 perhaps per session, certainly when France are playing. Now, this to me is liftoff. This is it. This is what I wanted Olympic sevens to be from the start. So if I think it'll crack it this time. And I think then you get the visibility of that. You will get the other big Olympic nations starting to really take an interest in it. And you might get India, China, whatever, putting programs in place. So I think this is a very, very crucial moment for sevens development, because the front of house, it's never been bigger. This is going to be it. This is going to be the biggest selling point for sevens ever, I think.
Yeah, the men's sessions have sold out. Bear in mind, we play before the Olympics start. So our first 2 days are before the opening ceremony, and then the finals day is the day after the opening ceremony. So that's, and then the women's is, I think, is like 60-70% sold at the moment. But it's a big stadium they're trying to fill. And you're right. And I think, you know, having the Messiah playing as well, probably for France, will be massive as well. But in its own right, I think that if they can get momentum here, then you're going into LA 2028. And that's the key is you've got to capture the eyeballs from the TV right now. The thing about the American sporting landscape is the Olympics is everything. So if they can capture their teams that have an opportunity to be medals, then they become fans for a day that can turn into 2 days, that can be turned into a week. Then all of a sudden they're experts on rugby, I think. So, I think it is a massive opportunity. I think Tokyo had everything apart from the fact COVID done us over. Yeah. Because it was right off the back of the World Cup and everything. So, I'd agree with that.
We've sort of flirted with talking about Dupont. Well, except for when Chewy had a go. Oh, no, Brendan had a go at his bald spot, which I would say probably wasn't particularly
We all have our weaknesses.
Yeah. That is only one, to be fair. Mike, just talk about the impact, even before Olympics, the waves it made when the announcement was made. Obviously, he played at LA Vancouver. His highlight reel from just those two tournaments was pretty ridiculous on its own. Just speak about from the outside, but from the inside, how the reaction has been.
Yeah, I mean, like anything, right? I think he's brave, right? Because he doesn't need to put his reputation on the line. And there are many that have come across the sevens and been found out because it's a very unforgiving, lonely place out there with a lot of space to defend and attack. But what Dupont did really, really well was he came in and he didn't try and reinvent the wheel. He didn't try and come up with $1 million players or anything like that. Attacking wise, he was very straightforward. He would move the ball like he normally did quickly. He'd have a look, but he'd move it probably more so than he normally would in the 15s. And he looked for second and third touches to be links. And he only ever went when it was really, really 100% on. And he played the team game. And he just blended in and he got on it. Where he was exceptional, and I think this comes from the way he carries himself and his confidence, defensively, he didn't overchase anything, which is what tendency you do when you come to sevens because you're worried about the space. He just stuck to his system. He trusted his acceleration and he just moved effortlessly defensively. That's where he didn't do a lot, but he didn't do anything wrong, right? And if you're going to be successful in the game of sevens, you don't get found out in your first two legs. He didn't deserve to be in the dream team week one, but he was always going to be in the dream team for week one because he made a decision to play. But week two, we saw a real improvement. And he was really, really integral in terms of all the link play in attack, but also his defensive work was fantastic. And he is exceptionally strong. He is exceptionally fit. And he's the first, what we would say, world star, really, to come across in his prime. So most of them come across at the end. He came across in his prime and he was able to adapt physically straight away, which was his biggest asset, because the others have always struggled for that adaptation. But when you're one of the fittest 15 players in the world as it is, the week one, he was managing to do 7-8 minutes. And then by week two, he kind of had that confidence to go kind of 14 minutes. But the biggest thing I can say about him is he just fitted in. And that's the mark of the man, I think. When you watch him, the way he was around the hotel, in the team room, he just wanted to be Antoine, that was one of the blokes that, it's all about these guys. I'm just going to here to try and help. His external presence for the other 12 French was exponential because all of a sudden, right, well, we got Dupont. And that, when you bring confidence in a young man, it's dangerous. Yeah. And they become a handful. And they became a handful.
He does come across in 15s, Mike, I think, as quite a humble guy, I would say a natural team bloke. He came out of that Osh Academy, which has been, and that's a once grand club fallen on hard times, but he's come out of that, out of that system and into the Toulouse system. And Toulouse are so successful that I suppose they are in a position to be able to say, no matter how good you are, buddy, you're only as good as the other 14 around you. So, just rein it in a bit if he ever reined it out, which he probably didn't. He does seem to be a natural team player.
Yeah, I was, he's a lovely guy. And, you can see in his eyes, though, he's got killer. Like, I mean, he's got killer in his eyes. But at the end of the game, and before the game, in and around the food hall, he doesn't want for anything differently. Yeah, I mean, I think the way he conducts himself and the way that he blends himself in around the other 12 or 13 was testament to the man, you know, and he was getting a lot of attention, and he's like, he felt uncomfortable with that because it's not about me, it's about them.
So you were a scrum half, mate. In a word, is he any good?
He's decent, to be fair to him. Yeah, he's proper decent. I mean, he's what I love about him is his work off the ball. I mean, it's phenomenal, his support lines. And he's so strong. Jesus, he's so strong. Like, you know, you thought he would have got exposed a little bit defensively on the sevens because of it. And I know they're smaller men, but they're moving very, very quickly and they change direction. His ability to hold people in the tackle whilst changing direction. He's some athlete.
The comparison is that's often made is with Gareth Edwards, actually, who you'll remember him because he came to train just after you. But I mean, it was all hips and bum with Gareth, but there was an upper body strength as well. I mean, he does seem to come out of that kind of bracket.
Yeah, I mean, his neck, he's got a cow neck. He's got a cow neck. I mean, he's obviously worked, because he was very small, wasn't he, as a young man? And he's had to work exceptionally hard. You can just see that work ethic. You can see that desire. You can see that killer in him. When all's said and done, then you see his lovely smile. I mean, he was playing with Reeds, who I think came through the same academy, and when they went to school together, and he was the captain of France. And probably that was probably quite a nice thing for him. To have that kind of familiar face that he can be himself and not be treated as this superstar that he is, which must have been interesting for the French players, because these guys are all fringe top 14 pro dirt players or centrally contracted. So, you know, the other end of the spectrum to DuPont. So I would hazard a guess some of them were in awe and were interested about how he was going to fit in. And he certainly did that. Nothing but good things to say about the bloke, which is disappointing because he's playing for the opposition.
Well, question is, Mike, and for France, the sort of million-dollar question is he good enough to make an even bigger impact? You say he's very much slotted in as the team player, doesn't appear to have massive ego and so on and so forth. What's his potential in sevens? That's what really interests me. How good could he be? Because I sometimes watch him 15s, and he'll go quiet for a bit because he's sussing out what's going on and where the holes are, and then suddenly he goes again. And when he goes, it's usually devastating.
I mean, part of me's gutted that he had to go back to Toulouse, because I think if it had had the continuity of playing three or four tournaments, just the impact he made over a back-to-back week, I think he'd have been the star without shadow at Paris. Because he's obviously a naturally gifted athlete. He's a very, very good rugby player. And like you said, he's a very shrewd and sharp and quick learner of the problems he's facing. But I think coming in and out is going to be hard. And obviously with Toulouse doing what they're doing in the European Cup, he won't be in Madrid. He'll be taking care of business there, and then he will then be parachuted in for the Olympics. So how they get him game time in that lead up so he can sharpen his tools will be interesting and important for him. But to answer your question, had he been given continuity of four or five tournaments, he probably would have been one of the best players at the Olympic without a doubt. And there are some really good players like Isgro and Mineta. Terry Kennedy, you know, they are fine rugby players, and you know, Isgro made the transfer across to 15s in the World Cup, and may go. Mineta will probably go afterwards. Kennedy's just an exceptional kind of talented footballer that's athletically gifted, but also suits the sevens game. DuPont is that freak that can do both, right? You know, very similar to like Jonah, but in a different way. Jonah could just do both, and make very big impacts in a different way, very quickly in both forms of the game. Christian Cullen was another one, right? Christian Cullen could do that. He could turn up on a sevens field and probably within three or four games, it's like, wow. And then you could pop him back into into the Hurricanes back line and he'd do a job.
I mean, you've obviously portrayed Dupont very flatteringly, and except calling his neck that of a cow, but we'll one thing that has really interested me is when they won, it was LA that France won. I think they came second in Vancouver, was it? And then won LA. So obviously the impact was pretty quick. But the way he celebrated there was kind of a side we've never seen with him before. You know, he seemed really out of his shell and just joshing around with the France team as well. And then also we saw him interviewing in English, which you see so rarely, and you see a snippet into his personality. So would you say that there's a slightly unhinged is probably the wrong word, but the shackles have come off a little bit when he goes over to the seven side as well. And it's his sort of, you know, as sevens is to 15, sevens is rugby, but fun in the sun.
But it's a bit more freedom, right? And don't forget, when you come in the World Series, it's a traveling circus. It's like he had to get his head around the fact that he was eating lunch, dinner and breakfast with the other 15, the other 12 teams, when normally they're in their own hotel in isolation. And I think those kind of adjustments give you a different perspective. And everybody is friends, being candid and comrades, until battle lines are drawn. And then it's all business. And then when it's all finished. But don't forget, he'd have been changing in the changing room with three other teams. So he's got all of those kind of adjustments, which will be new to him. And I think a very important piece was Reeves. Obviously, having his mate from school obviously allows him to be him, because he's not got to be the face of France rugby, even though he is the face of France rugby, even on the world circuit. He's just one of the guys. And you saw that insight into him where, you know, like you said, it's the pressure's off a little bit, right?
I think there's almost two sides to Dupont. He is an incredibly intense player and he rarely smiles on the pitch. He just gets on with business. But I've followed him on social media for quite a few years, and there is that other side. He really stops to smell the roses. I mean, he's always posting. I mean, for the last 5 or 6 years, whenever Toulouse or even when he was at Castres have a good win, he's always posting a picture of the team, either celebrating in the changing room or having a meal or a drink. He goes down the beach with Ntamack and they go skimboarding and surfing. He's always posting pictures of that. There's definitely two sides of him, and he compartmentalizes rugby. Fun, I think, with him, and that's him.
Does this so with Dupont playing, and is it confirmed you don't think there's any chance of him playing Madrid? Obviously, it's a week between the Champions Cup final and Madrid.
I can't see Toulouse doing it. And the fact of the matter is that the French, when this deal would have been done, it would have been all about the Olympics, and it coincided. I think if Toulouse had gone out, he would have been there.
Of course,
and I think Toulouse will sacrifice the top 14. Maybe I don't know where they sit in the playoffs on that front, but I don't think they'd sacrifice this. I think that was probably a condition, and I probably think Dupont wouldn't want to go to Madrid over that final.
I'm not suggesting he won't play the final.
No, but do you know what I mean? That kind of sense, I think the final is the weekend before Madrid.
Yes.
I think he would feel uncomfortable about then being parachuted into Madrid. Do you know what I mean? He'd be like, man, these boys have worked hard. I'll earn my right come Olympic camp, which will be a week after. And that's the prize they're after. They're after the gold medal. And I think that's where kind of all eyes are on the prize for him, which, you know, it's a shame for some, you know, us that we're not going to see him in Madrid. But, you know, the other guy I wanted to see was Penno. I thought, I was hoping he'd come across, but I think he had a big box office.
Well, I was going to ask you what 15s player, and we all would have loved to see Penno. Give us another couple of names that you think would make. I mean, there are the obvious, like Doohan van der Merwe, I think would be very good. Mine would be, I'd love to see Lavani Bottia give it a go. I think he'd be a pretty...
That's where he started.
Yeah, well, of course, give it another go.
Antonio?
I don't think they'd lose a scrum if they had him in. So, and they'd be able to play with six in the back line.
I was going to say, you could play 6-8, couldn't you?
I'd like to see, and I don't know whether it happened or not, I'd like to see Arundel have a crack.
He's on my list as well.
I'd like to see Aaron go look for it.
The rumours are that Radwan is is going to GB. I'm not sure that's obviously they've confirmed Ellie Kildan and Meg Jones this week on the women's side. I'm not sure whether Radwan's actually.
I think it has been confirmed. Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Radwan's been confirmed.
It has been confirmed. Okay.
I mean, the difference is that GB have got to qualify still.
Yeah.
But the girls are already there. I mean, I you know, on the girls' side, I'd like to have seen Alex Matthews go back across, and I'd love to have seen Abby Dow go.
Yeah.
Watching Abby Dow play 15s, and she never actually played 7s, I don't think, but I don't know if this is a compliment to her or not. It's like watching the female Josh Lucy. I like Josh at 7s as a fast prop was exceptional, and that ended up leapfrogging him to get back into Clive's plans. But Abby Dow is, obviously, we know she's immensely quick, but she's deceptively strong and powerful, and I think she would be a real game changer if GB got hold of her. Not as a winger, I'd have played her as a fast forward.
I'd say Manny Fembo-Bosa would be a 7s player.
Sorry, go on, Brad.
I'd say down at Exeter, Manny Fembo-Bosa would be a great 7s player.
Yeah.
I'd want to see him in action.
Who are favourites for the Olympics, Mike?
On the men's side, I would say on the men's side, when they get Mineta back, I would say Argentina, who are a team that have been together since 2016-17, and they're a mixture of a couple of experienced boys, but a lot of boys that have come through. They were unplayable for about three legs. So I'd probably say their favourite. New Zealand might be far away, but... and then on the women's side, it's crazy because you've got New Zealand and Australia, but France can be absolutely box office and they're not. And I think both the French teams will be typical French in Paris and it will go one of two ways. But I'd say the bookies' favourites are RG's on the men's side. And I probably go that when all's said and done, the New Zealanders on the women's side tied with the Australians, but I just think they've got the mental edge at the moment. And they're hoping they'll get Hirini back.
Sarah, what's happened Hirini to Fiji back on the men's side, Mike? Or should we not even be worried that they will turn up and then maybe just pick another squad and turn up and win it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like on the islands there. They've got so many good players that it's just, can you get them all pointing in the same direction at the same time? And, you know, when Ben Ryan won the original one and when Babs won it in Tokyo, they had the most important guy in their teams was the S&C boy called Naka, who's now doing the Drua. Right? He does the Fijian team, right? Because he got the alignment and the buy-in from the S&C side. So they're just struggling on where they are at the moment as a group. They're obviously insanely talented. They could just turn up and blow the doors off. But what's happening at the moment, they're a little bit all over the shop. Where sevens has changed over the last kind of 5 or 6 years is if you are slightly off, it doesn't matter who you are, you get knocked over. And Fiji are kind of feeling that right now. And they've got a few internal things that they're trying to work through.
I'm right in saying that the seedings for the Olympics are dictated by the league standings from the season.
The last 2 years, the last two and a half years, yeah.
Okay.
Up until Singapore.
So you guys are likely to have quite a tough group then.
Well, there is no easy group, right? But don't forget you've got outside qualifiers. So you've got so far qualified are Japan and Kenya from outside the World Series. So there, and then there's the World Repechage one, which could be Great Britain or South Africa or Spain or Canada. I mean, that's a brutal. World Repechage. You don't want to. That's nearly as bad as being in relegation roulette. But it's a bad place to have to go and try and get your last chance saloon to get to the Olympics because you've got the believe it or not, probably again, this is no disrespect to Kenya or Japan, the Olympic group is probably easier than the World Series.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the Olympics, just for those that don't understand, it's 12 teams.
Yeah.
Three pools, but it's weirdly, it's not the same 12 that are in the World Seven Series, which I suppose makes sense if it's the past couple of years. So the nations that have qualified so far.
Kenya, Japan, yeah. Samoa, USA, France, Australia, Fiji, New Zealand, Argentina.
Ireland.
And Ireland.
Ireland, okay.
Spots
left, yeah.
Well done, Nick.
Which seems bizarre, obviously, because, I don't know, a nation like Samoa has not been firing. And, well, South Africa are one of the top five, top six teams, and they're not in there.
So yeah, it's not unusual, though. In basketball, the World Championship is always it's always stronger than the Olympic event, because the Olympic has to have regional continental qualifiers to be Olympics. And that's fine. And that's great, because you do get that nice mix in the Olympics. But if you're looking for the absolute World Championship, if you like, it's the World Championship, the World Series in sevens. That is where you get all the best teams on merit all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, Uruguay is the other team that's qualified for the Olympics. So they have to have representation globally. And as a consequence, South Africa had a one-off slip-up against Kenya in the Africa qualifier, and that was that, you know. And it's ruthless.
Yeah.
So it's just one out of that repechage, is it?
Yeah, just one. There's one spot left.
And who are the four? Sorry, you said South Africa, Canada,
GB, Spain,
and GB. Spain
and GB. Christ.
Ooh, that's hard.
And you've got people like Tonga, and and they're all capable of an upset as well. That's the point. And you know, the thing about sevens is, you know, it's so volatile, right? The first kickoff could go up, you could misjudge the timing, get a red card, and all of a sudden you're playing 40 minutes with six men. And, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, that just changes the whole dynamic of a game.
And where is that repechage, Mike? That sounds like a weekend worth getting to.
Monaco. Yeah, definitely. Monaco.
Definitely a weekend worth getting to.
you can pop in the casino as well, Brendan.
Yeah, no, the repechage is the same weekend as Madrid. Isn't it?
No, it's 2 weeks after Madrid.
Oh, 2 weeks after. Sorry, forgive me.
Yeah.
You've been doing quite a lot of work on sevens, Ollie, you were saying the other week.
Yeah, I know, I have, which is why I should really know that, to be honest. But I'm not working on the repechage.
No, I wasn't going down that road. I wasn't saying
I don't know, that was a bit of a tone, Chewy. That was a bit of a tone. What was I gonna say? Oh, you throw me off now. You mentioned Australia and New Zealand on the women's side as potential. And obviously, you have, you know, the final this weekend in Singapore was quite something, because you had both teams level on points.
Yeah.
The very first time. And then they had a shootout. Michaela Blythe scored three tries and for the third final in a row, which is pretty ridiculous. And then it was all over. But I think just a brief word for Singapore pitch, which has taken quite a few names. Sheree Kaka's now out of the Olympics. I don't know if you've seen Maddie Ashby's just been confirmed as out of the Olympics.
Yeah, I lost Joe as well, Joe Schroeder.
Yes, Joe Schroeder. Just anything about that pitch and whether it's particularly wise, because it's quite notorious for knees in particular.
But that's a proper grass pitch.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was a good surface. So my question was, is it the pitch? Or is it because we had one less week and the travel? Because we did Hong Kong and normally we have 5 weeks and it was 4 weeks and we all had 8-hour time zone changes and 16-hour flights. We had to go back and then come back again. But, you know, we can suggest that. We don't know that scientifically. But then you look at someone like Argentina, who had they had a 34-hour journey to get to Hong Kong, a 34-hour journey to get back, and then another 34-hour journey to come back in for Singapore 3 weeks later. Now, they didn't have any injuries. So, as long as it's...
But to be fair, they performed badly in Singapore and Hong Kong by their high standards.
Well, they did. And, you know, but I suppose the question is, I'm looking at where I'm more interested in is the consistency between the tournaments, because when I look at the pitches, the Singapore pitch, it's a decent surface and a decent pitch. So but I understand that the narrative and the point, right? Because ultimately the stats don't lie, right? There's four or five ACLs, then you're like, wow, why is that? And that's the bit they need to look at. And they can't just go straight to the pitch. I think they need to look at a number of factors and variables here. And, you know, we either needed to move it out a week, or we needed to make sure that teams came in maybe earlier. Because don't forget, the way that the World Series works, you're only paid for 4 days before. So then it's up to you whether as a union you can afford to come in additional days. Whereas with that travel schedule, should it have been everybody has to be in 7 days before, because of the proprioception adjustments that were back and forth over that, you know, that, I mean, that's where the scientists have got to do their bits, and then there's got to be a take a step back, and then what seems right.
Yeah. It is a remarkable thing, isn't it, that Singapore should be littered with ACLs, which is the first litter seen in Singapore for 20 years.
Chewy, that was a forced from Mike, just in case you were any.
I mean, it's a very clean city.
Well, I was simply making the point that Singapore is, forget it. If you have to repeat a joke, it's rubbish.
Correct. That's the first time you've admitted your jokes are rubbish. I want to do the quick fire question round with you, but before, just to, you know, put you on the spot a little bit, I think I did send them to you in advance, but just before I do that, there's another Friday that I'd love for you to tell us about, and that's Lucas, who just won a bunch of man of the matches for England under 18s.
He's doing well. He's just started his A levels. He's got to do his A levels the next month, so he's a bit grumpy. But he's got to get through that, and then he starts work for Quinns July 1st. So no, he's doing really well. He's had a horrible 8 months. He got injured playing for England 18s in South Africa, missed his final year of school rugby, and managed to get himself back fit to be picked for England to play in the 18s Six Nation. I was amazed at how well he played. And I'm biased because I'm his dad, but. He did fantastically well. He just adjusted, got stuck in. He's got a little bit of me in him, but he can pass and kick, which is something I couldn't do. So he's doing great. He's got his head down, and he's working well. And I see him up there when he was on his debut. I'm really, really, really pleased with him.
Has he signed a contract with Quinns then?
He signed with Quinns. So he starts at July 1st. It's great, really, because Danny's there, and I coached Danny as a 16-year-old. So I had Danny in the Junior National Academy as a 16, 17, 18-year-old, and he came with me to Commonwealth Games back in the day. So it's the circle of life, really. I said, well, I did some bits for you. Now you're going to do some bits this end.
Is he going to juggle Quinns with uni, or is he going to... Okay.
No, he's definitely. So he could have gone. He had a lot of options to go to uni, but he's going to go to Surrey. So he's on site. He's already trying to negotiate with me about part time and all of that, which we're not doing year one. I'm very, very, very busy. No, you're not. You've got more than enough time to do year one of uni. He's going to do business management. I think that's important, right? As a young man to build relationships and interact with people that don't just love rugby. So I want to be able to hold conversations with people that don't find rugby interesting.
University will make a man of him, Mike.
Yeah, 100%.
So you can then call him Man Friday.
Yeah.
How good is that? Here all week and twice on Sundays. It's fantastic.
Chewy, I'm actually proud of you. Well done.
A good recovery, to be fair.
That was a good recovery. That was good. Oh, well, good on him. Good on him. And good luck to him with A-levels in next year. A-levels, yeah, they're underway, and they'll be done in a month, won't he? So
that's it. He's got a month's pain.
Yeah, a month's pain, and then he'll enjoy himself, I'm sure, until July. Go time.
Enjoy himself for a week, and then you've got pre-season. And then
yeah, oh, God. Right, let's do those 15. I did send them to you, didn't I?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Let's do them, and then we'll wrap up. Nickname?
Geezer.
Yeah, I enjoyed your... I won't say what your email address is, obviously, but I enjoyed your email. Yeah. Didn't even feature your name. Yeah. Best rugby memory?
My best rugby memory is actually when we was at Wasps, 93, when we won the Middlesex Sevens, all young guns, me, young Lawrence... Both Lawrences, Lawrence Delalio, Lawrence Grace, young Paul Volley. We were all like 20, 21, and we beat Samoa in the semi-final, who were the Hong Kong winners at the time. We were 24-0 down against Northampton and Dunham 26-24. So, and it was a packed Twickenham, it was in 90. It was packed. So, and it was back then when everybody just ran the pitch. So, yeah. That was a fantastic day. It's a good night as well, but it was a decent night.
Most embarrassing rugby memory.
Embarrassing one is probably going to the trials at Kent 18s and having to tell them what school I went to, and they were like, "What?" And then they just made me sit over in the side, and I got given 1 minute at the end, and then wished on my way. And it was, I didn't know whether to feel upset, ashamed, disappointed. I don't know what it was, but it set a flame in me. But at the time, as a 17-year-old, I was like proper down in the dumps.
Pre-game tune.
I'm a big Pink man. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, trustful, you know, anything like that. I mean, any chance I get to go and watch Pink in concert, I'm there. I'm in.
She does a thing in concert where she's on like some big trapeze thing.
Yeah, you know, fantastic. Yeah. Cool. I don't do that before the game.
Post-game meal.
That's not so long ago since I played, but probably would be down the old chippy for the sausage and batter with chips, with a dipping the old sausage in the salad cream.
That's because of the school you went to.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Best player you've played or coached against?
Best player I've played against would be Gary Armstrong. When we were at the Falcons, he was a handful. He was Jesus.
Best player you've played with or coached with or coached? Sorry.
Best player I've coached. Oh wow! Probably. Oh, there's a few, but I would probably say in terms of just all round talent is Matthew Tate.
Nice. Favorite player right now?
Dupont. I mean, he's phenomenal.
Rugby idol.
Jeremy Guscott. I used to love watching him as a honestly. And then when I met him, and he's pretty decent off the pitch in the bar as well, to be fair to him. He lived up to everything there. But yeah, I used to love watching him play for England in the centre. He was
We played for the same junior club, Mike.
Unbelievable.
And yeah. and between us, we have about 9 Lions test caps.
Yeah. And a drop goal.
Favorite stadium?
Hong Kong.
Nice. Oh, so you must be pretty gutted that it's moving.
Well, yeah, they said it's moving, and they said, oh, maybe it's one more year. Yeah, because I think they're behind on the build. So unless they're going to chuck 10,000 labourers in it, which they might do, because it is Hong Kong. It could be one more year.
Oh God, we made such a song and a dance about it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, there. Christ, okay. Favourite gym exercise?
Bench, yeah. I'm not very good at it anymore, but bench.
Occupation if rugby didn't exist?
I would be a chartered surveyor.
Superstitions?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. I kind of, if I'm wearing a hat and we win, then I'll keep wearing it.
You've got your fair share of bucket hats, don't you?
I do like a bucket hat, and I do kind of change and mix it up. But if it's working well, then it's in. It's there. It's staying. So I had one when we won London Sevens that very first time of USA. It was raining day one and I had a beanie on. And the next day it was blistering hot. And I was wearing this beanie. Yeah, and I looked an absolute idiot. But
yeah. You speak about hair, lovely haircuts. Your hair must have been a bit tragic after that.
Well, it's tragic the best of times. It is what it is.
Rugby law you would change, sevens or non-sevens?
The caterpillar. Oh, my God. Right. It's
killing me. I don't think I'll ever be a caterpillar in sevens.
Killing me.
Best thing about working in rugby, final one?
For me, I just love the smiles that you see when blokes or women achieve what they want to achieve, right? Be it that win or be it they get that little breakthrough moment. I mean, I love that. I love that.
Great stuff. Amazing. All right, Mike. Well, we'll wrap up there. We obviously wish you the very best in Madrid and obviously in the Olympics. When are you flying out to France after Madrid?
I will go back to the States. We'll do fine. We've got Japan coming over to do some games with us. And then We will select and we will move to Paris about the 13th of July. So
I don't even know when. When's the start date? I don't even know that.
Something like the 26th, 27th.
Yeah, it's a couple
not of far days. Away, is it?
10 days of training.
No, it's about 6 days. Hard. Yeah, and it's weird because you have to, when you come to the Olympics, because you're not governed by, you're governed by IOC, you've got to name your squad. You're playing for 2 or 3 weeks out, which you don't normally do, but
yeah.
Then you've got to manage them going into preservation mode and still fulfilling their training.
Yeah.
So different challenges.
Well, we can't wait to watch. I don't know if any, I haven't asked any of the columnists if they're going out actually, but I'm trying to sort out some last minute tickets. But like you say, it's pretty sold out on the sevens front. Yeah. And yeah, with the Messiah factor, like you say, I think it's going to be Brendan put it well, it's going to be sevens lift off.
There are tickets available for the skateboarding, Ollie.
Were you looking this morning?
Yeah, well, I already have mine, but I was looking for other people.
Thanks, Chewy. I'll keep that in mind. Yeah, Mike, great having you, and go well for the rest of the season. We can't wait for the Olympics.
Cheers, Ollie.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Rugby Paper Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use and recommend the show to your friends. The Rugby Paper is available to buy every Sunday. And to make sure you don't miss it, subscribe through our print, digital and online options at therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions. That's therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions to get all our content for as little as 14p per day.